I'm Pam Druckerman, and this is Tell Me What You Really Think, where I sit down with innovators and changemakers to talk about the role of the media, conversations that are becoming more and more critical every day. I'm happy to be back with a special episode focused around how both media and marketing have needed to shift as consumer behavior continues to evolve faster than light. This is something that I've seen personally on the front lines at Condé Nast, and I've invited two guests from very different industries to dive deeper into the topic with me. First, I'll be talking to Kaylee Barber, a media editor at the digital industry must-read Digiday, about the changing media industry and how strategies have needed to change. Then, Patrick Urban is here, the president of North America at MERS Aesthetics. We'll be talking about how he needed to flip the script in marketing and his personal philosophy on leadership in these tough times. Cool. All right, so let's get into it. First up, Kaylee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm excited you're here too. Kaylee, you cover revenue diversification within the digital media industry, including e-commerce, licensing, virtual events, membership, general advertising, all with Digiday, one of the leading voices on covering disruption in the digital media landscape. Other areas you focus on are blockchain. You and I have to get some drinks to talk about crypto and the metaverse, the future of work, diversity and inclusion, and other large industry trends. So clearly, we have a lot of podcasts to pursue. At industry events like Advertising Week, you've been the one asking the questions.
Yeah.
So let me take the opportunity to switch that up on you. I think we're all about flipping the script today, so we'll do that. So question number one, considering the quickly changing landscape, what are you optimistic about? Is there anything to be optimistic about in the future of the media and marketing industries in general?
There is a lot to be optimistic about. I think that because there has been so much pressure put on digital advertising in particular, and some of the challenges around, you know, where you're finding audiences and how publishers can make sure that their traffic isn't disappearing towards all the platforms, there's been a really interesting crackdown on kind of finding alternates to these avenues, right? So I think with cookie deprecation, I guess to start there, because I'm sure that's on a lot of people's minds, there's been kind of a need to reposition what makes for like a strong digital campaign and really kind of advocating for first party data, contextual targeting, things like that. And I think it's a very big testing year in that regard. And I think there will be a lot of positives that come out of that. But ultimately, I think it's still revving up, right? So like, I'm optimistic about where the industry is moving kind of together and willing to test and learn together. And based on the conversations I've had with publishers, there's also been, I think, a slow return of ad revenue as a result of that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And think about like early days of, I don't know, platform buying, or even early days of, you know, how you would even talk about like digital streaming. Most advertisers would say they knew what consumer they were reaching. They didn't know where they were reaching them. Mm-hmm. They didn't know against what content or what environment, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think what's interesting is as privacy has kicked into gear, as targeting has gotten harder, you know, finding that right consumer at the right time with the right message, all of those things are now like kind of up in the air, right?
Yep.
And so I think this is where publishers now have an opportunity to, I think, have a little bit more of the power, right? Because we own the environment. And ultimately with that, then maybe we own a deeper relationship with that consumer at the same time. So if there's one like signpost that the industry is about to be turned on its head, you know, let's talk about how Google today is not delivering the traffic it used to. That to me, I don't know if I ever thought those words would come out of my mouth, but it's absolutely true. And part of this is consumers using social media for search, right? People are searching on the TikTok platform, on the Meta platform, you know, for everything from restaurant recommendations to like what car they're buying. I actually just did that. And platforms are trying hard to keep their audiences on their sites. That's what the algorithm change was meant for, to keep consumers there longer. So my question for you is, I mean, again, I don't want to get too media speaky, but I guess that's the point of you and I talking right now. You know, is this a real change that we are seeing? Is traditional search actually at risk, or is this just something that like people are talking about right now?
There is a large concern that like with the role of AI being incorporated into search results and Google eventually rolling out their AI chatbot kind of search piece of it.
Yeah,
there is a concern that that will further decrease referral traffic because their results will be moved down further on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, publishers definitely, in the conversations I've had and looking at the data, are seeing decreases in referral traffic on that medium. And I think also with social, you're right, like there is an algorithm shift that's really encouraging people to consume all of their media in one place, right? Like the, I'm sure TikTok scroll times and even like YouTube algorithm is like really focused on keeping people consuming what's next and maintain that like scrolling habit.
I also think in the platform experience, if you think about what purpose a brand should play there, whether you're Vogue or you're a fashion brand that we work with, I mean, ultimately, yes, it's to build your brand, build communities, but it is to drive engagement. It is to like make that connection with that consumer. And so I do think like how we rethink KPIs, you know, people talk about the attention economy, it's nothing new, but it really is like not all moments in any setting are created equal. I would argue that Oscars is a cultural moment that is going to drive probably more attention, or the Super Bowl, than just any other Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
So I think that that is a huge opportunity for us. And I think it's interesting because I'm hearing this from marketers literally yesterday. They want to know how much time consumers are spending with their content and their message. Do you think that this kind of next phase of measurement, what do you think that will actually look like? Because people keep talking about it, but I'm curious what you think it'll actually look like.
I definitely think there's a breaking away of those like low calorie KPIs like viewability or click-through rate.
Oh, I like that, low calorie.
Yeah.
I love anything low calorie.
Well, I am definitely taking that phrase from another person I interviewed previously, but it was really applicable to this kind of idea because for a long time, especially with digital advertising, like viewability and click-through rate, I think were the big focuses for how to measure success there. It's making those metrics look way less appealing despite how cheap they are to actually get. You're then seeing a switch towards, all right, well, like, let's look at engagement. Let's look at like what they did after clicking, you know, this ad, or trying to find like the attribution line and things of that nature. And I do think that those metrics are in conversation more, but I don't necessarily think it's the same budget that's allocated towards maybe reaching someone on a general Wednesday. You know what I mean? Like advertisers, when they're working with digital media partners, are looking for bigger and fewer engagements or deals with their trusted partners versus taking a, you know, super extensive, like ongoing approach in digital media.
Mm-hmm. And I think given the choice, the irony is we come from a world where, you know, when they were buying TV, marketers had the opportunity to buy Thursday night, right? Thursday night was a better night. There was better shows, better audiences, better network. And I think that's where cultural moments and events come in, or culture as a KPI. You know, relatedly, one of the things you wrote about last year was about how publishers like Condé Nast were doubling down on launching events, right? And specifically, you focused on how experiential franchises can become content creation studios. There's a feeling that everything that's old again is new in some ways, talking about events as a cornerstone of marketing plans. I mean, I don't know if you've been hearing, everyone's been calling us asking for a outdoor inventory, which I never thought I'd hear again. I'm like, if anyone calls me for a taxi top, I'm going to laugh. But, you know, the reality is there's a reason for that. I think you have this, you know, Gen A generation, you know, following Gen Z, and digital is not anything new to them, right? It's 100% not breaking through the way that social media was breaking through. Culture or cultural moments are the things that really are breaking through. You know, driving through the streets of Paris and seeing an amazing billboard are breaking through. Outdoor and airports are breaking through. Magazines are breaking through. But I'm just kind of curious, where is this upswing coming from? And where do you think it goes? Like, I don't think culture has ever, you know, people talk about it as a new KPI, but it's always been.
Yeah. Gen A, Gen Z, they're not really moved by digital because they're on a screen for most part of the day. I'm on a screen for most of my day. And so I think it's the old is new is definitely right on. The in-person moments have not only the opportunity to kind of like capture attention, break out of that like monotony of scrolling or what have you. But if someone's going to an event, they're locked in. They like the brand that's hosting it. They like the talent that's on stage. And then I think the very successful pieces of an in-person either event or billboard, for your example, is something that will also go viral because of how
you just nailed that.
Different it is. Like, I don't know, the Calvin Klein ads that are in Soho. The number of pictures I saw of Jeremy Allen White's, you know,
yes,
underwear campaign, that I think has the same ability to kind of break the internet, as people like to call it.
Yes, and I will just add into that. I'm so glad you said that, because I think the new of what was old, meaning billboards, magazines, cultural moments, these are all content generators, mm-hmm. right? They're catalysts. They are what are growing the internet, breaking the internet. They're what people are socializing. The term like social, you know, comes from this idea that people are actually like engaging, building community, have something to talk about, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen so many Vogue covers, you know, start out as just cover experiences, then turn into big viral moments. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there's just so much happening. And then there's the rise of AI. Mm. So there's no way of having a podcast that talks about tech or media that doesn't ask about AI. So right now we're talking about search within platforms, but let's just say it's going to change again probably by next week. So are you seeing challenges when it comes to the combination of AI and content? Do you think there's another way of looking at it? What's your perspective?
I think there is a lot of opportunity and there's a lot of risk with AI being incorporated in media businesses. I think even particularly in like a news capacity. And it's interesting because I was at an event last year and the CEO of OpenAI was being interviewed. And even he was saying the benefits of AI in media are going to come with a lot of challenges as well. The use within content production that ends up being shown to audiences. You see like Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, they
really messed up on that one. And pretending like a human generated a story that was clearly written by AI is going to be a downfall for those who are not very cautious about how they're approaching it.
You know, I think technology is amazing. And I think what AI is going to allow us to do is going to blow our minds. Like everyone's excited about 5G. I don't think anyone could really tell the difference between 5G and 3G. But the truth is AI is going to change the way that we live, mm-hmm. the way that we interact in many ways. But I do think there is an interesting kind of opinion rising about like the bot versus the human. And the bot definitely gets like a bad rap. I mean, even my son, he's like, ugh, so-and-so in my class, she's just a bot, you know, like not a real person, not real opinions. And I do think there's something to that around our culture. And so I think there's going to be a premiumness around creativity mm-hmm. and how to use AI as a tool. And I think there's going to be a premiumness around being able to prove that, you know, that you're a real journalist or that you make real content. So I think that's good for you.
Well, if AI is being used as a way to generate a lot of content that will surface on a search result or add more ad inventory mm-hmm. to a publisher website, that's a losing game. I don't think that has anything differentiated. And oftentimes, the AI-generated content is scraping someone else's
exactly.
like, individually reported, uniquely reported story. But it will, to your point, put actually reported, human-generated content in a better position because it's going to be the premium option.
Yeah.
There's nothing special about AI-generated, low-lift content.
It's like the difference between something that was like Hermes, something that was like the craftsmanship
yeah.
that went into actually making these bags by hand versus, you know, something that was made in a factory.
Yeah, handmade versus machine-made. I
Correct.
Think that's a great analogy. Yeah, is it hand-stitched on the bag or was it...
Right. The luxury community has made a lot of money out of the difference, right?
Oh, so much. Even recently raising the prices. Like it's
true.
There's
it's
hopefully
true.
The same case for publishers.
I think that there's so much value that will come out of, you know, where we're going with AI. But again, I think that there's going to be this pendulum swing and really important perspective of how we use this technology to help us move a lot faster, but also appreciating the difference between something that is organic or authentic and something that is just being like regurgitated and quite frankly, not necessarily like helping us move forward faster, just helping us move in the wrong direction. So we're going to end here. But in every episode of Tell Me What You Really Think, we have a series of rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
I am.
Okay, so I'll start with an easy one. Texting or talking?
Talking.
Musk or Zuck?
Ugh. suck, I guess.
Ooh, I'm going to come back to that. Favorite Condé Nast brand?
Oh, Architectural Digest.
Really?
Oh, I love Open Door.
Eggs or pancakes?
Pancakes.
What was the last song you streamed?
It was from Ariana Grande's new album, Eternal Sunshine.
Ooh, good one. How did I do hosting the podcast? And we're like role reversed. How'd I do?
Wonderfully.
You think
I
so?
I feel like I learned so much even in this conversation.
Well, thanks, Kaylee. I always love our discussions, and I anticipate more to come as the media world continues to evolve. Kaylee Barber, as I said before, is media editor at Digiday. Coming up, I'll be talking to Patrick Urban from MERS Aesthetics about how all this change affects his brand's marketing strategy and relationship with his consumer. Stay tuned. Patrick, it's great to have you here. I know you came all the way from Raleigh, North Carolina.
It's great to be here.
Where you're the president of North America at MERS Aesthetics, leading the region in strategy and operations. You have more than 20 years of experience in the sales industry, during which you specialized in revenue growth, new product launches, and strategic market and product planning. That's a lot.
Yeah, and all true.
And all true. That's good. Patrick is committed to driving commercial success by taking ownership of the customer experience and leading the aesthetics team to deliver trusted results. He's passionate about delivering confidence through medical aesthetics and brings the passion to work each day to inspire his teams. You and I have been working with each other for a while, thanks to MERS' long-term partnership with Condé Nast. I'm excited to be able to sit down and talk about more than just partnership negotiations. Coming off of my conversation with Kaylee from Digiday, I really want to dive into what all this industry change has meant for brands that you work on specifically. All right, so let's get into it.
Let's do that.
You've specialized in aesthetics through your career. You've led an organization with an industry which can be extremely complex, exciting, right, and competitive, and has an added layer of government regulation and oversight. In your career span, how has the business of medical aesthetics changed, especially as I understand that, similar to Condé Nast, MERS is, I think, a 100-plus-year-old company like us. Actually, for our listeners, can you explain what is medical aesthetics and how does MERS fit into that space? So two-part question.
Gotcha. So medical aesthetics is this emerging field. I would put it under the umbrella of modern medicine. And it really is using any sort of interventions or procedures cosmetically to help an individual look their best. And so under that umbrella could be things like medical-grade skincare, injectable products like fillers and toxins, all the way to devices like laser hair removal, could be facial devices, it could be lifting and tightening, all this whole spectrum of really cool and amazing things that today is becoming more and more popular.
You say lifting and tightening, you've got my attention. Yeah. I feel like I'm an expert on the topic. Okay, so your career has spanned significant pivot points when it comes to marketing, from the rise of digital and social as key channels to the new way of thinking of Web3 and communities. When I talked to Kaylee Barber from Digiday just a few minutes ago, one of the things I touched on was areas where search is just not delivering the way it used to. And I would imagine, especially when it comes to what you just described, that that would be important to a company like MERS. So let's talk about that. What's your opinion on that and what are your thoughts?
So I thought it was a fascinating conversation, by the way, around search and its role and how we need to sort of emerge and, I'll say, bolster that and understand what role that plays. So first of all, if we think about the aesthetics industry in general, you were talking earlier about, you know, the regulatory aspects of it and how we need to perform. It is definitely a business that is growing. We've seen changes in that business over the last few years. And I think they're very good and positive changes that speak well for the industry, but also speak well societally. In other words, what we see is new channels emerging, mm-hmm. right? Which gives rise to new entrepreneurs, which I think is a beautiful thing. In those new channels, it can be as simple as, you know, this used to be the domain of plastic surgeons, dermatologists, places like that. And they still are there and they still offer these treatments and procedures and they still operate med spas. But we see tremendous growth in med spas, sometimes from nurses who are leaving other aspects of that profession, learning injection techniques and becoming injectors, getting a medical director, which could be a physician from a different specialty or could be one of those we mentioned. And they're now setting up shop and opening a business. And I think that's a wonderful thing that sort of stimulates our economy and gives people new stepping off points. So as we see that continue to rise, we also see a younger demographic, sort of that younger Gen Z and younger millennial consumers becoming more and more interested in aesthetics, which means sort of that stigma that may have been associated with some of these things in the past is fading. I wouldn't say it's all but disappeared, but it's fading. And this has gone from an alleged vanity play, I never quite bought into that, but an alleged vanity play into something that's now become a pretty integrated part of some people's beauty regimen, which I think is amazing, right? And I think that that speaks to the continued evolution of where we're going in aesthetics. So now if we think about search and how that plays, it's clearly a subcomponent of our strategy, no question. But I think we have to create a more informed search. We have to give that consumer something to think about, to attach to our brand, to feel something about what we're offering, so that that search, however they're doing it, TikTok, Google, otherwise, can be more meaningful. That's really where we at MERS have sort of coined this new campaign that we've launched over the last couple of years called Beauty on Your Terms.
Right.
And that's really a campaign that focuses on our botulinum toxin A product called Xeomin. And that really seeks to take and transform what has been traditional.
But let me ask you this question.
Sure.
Because I could not agree with you more when it comes to the evolution of, now that I understand, all of the things that fall under the aesthetics umbrella. When you think of, you know, all the different products that ultimately used to be reserved for the doctor's office, for plastic surgeons. And now, to your point, you have all these nurses getting educated and having the opportunity to go open businesses and obviously within that find new consumers. And I do think that when you look at these types of products, when you look at these types of treatments, it's definitely attracting a younger consumer, 100%. But my question to you, though, recognizing what it is you'd be attaching search to what consumer with what level of education and how we're helping them now find something that is probably more in their control than it used to be, right? Thanks to science and thanks to, you know, products like yours. I think it's also interesting in this moment in time that search is not performing the way that it used to. It's not giving the same results to marketers like you that it might have 10 years ago at the moment when it's probably really important to help consumers get from, you know, this is something I found to where can I go get it? So I guess my question for you in this regard, are you seeing that degradation of search? Are you seeing that not working for your brand in the same ways? And how are you addressing it as a marketer?
So absolutely we are. But I love things like this that happen that cause evolution. Mm-hmm. Like I think catalysts to evolution are sort of how the world goes around. So something that we've relied on for a long time that sort of now forces us to pivot and forces us to be better or learn more or think differently. Greatness comes from those types of situations also. So I think it has forced us to rethink a lot of what we do. But in that context, we have come out with, you know, this Beauty on Your Terms campaign, which we believe is truly transformative. It takes everything that we used to think about from traditional pharmaceutical industry and sort of turns it upside down and adds a whole lot more layers to it. And so now we're not just talking about celebrity brand ambassadors, and we're not just talking about mega influencers with great reach, but we're talking about brand partners, and we're talking about cultural moments and integrating all of these components into cultural moments that occur throughout the year. And what does that do? That makes our product Xeomin culturally relevant to that audience. So when they go to search, they have a whole different thought process about it and they seek information differently. And by the way, let me just say, since we're here together, none of this would be possible without the paid partnership that we have with Condé Nast. It has been a beautiful, beautiful relationship, and I look forward to all the things we're going to do from here and looking forward.
Which is why you're one of the smartest, most innovative partners that we work with. No, but in all seriousness, though, you know, I had another partner say this, and I think this has a lot to do with where the industry is going, and you guys are leading, and kudos to you all. But this idea that, you know, moving away from something like, you know, share of wallet to word of mouth, right? And how do you get to that place? I read in Ad Age a quote from MERS Marketing that the top KPI for this campaign is being at the forefront of culture. And you just said it, right? People say that, though, And then they don't really know how to follow through on that. And clearly what you all are doing is, you know, setting quite an example. So that's music to my ears, obviously, because this is what I think we do very well. But what I think is super interesting is how not only there was this vision to be at the center of culture, but how, you know, your company is executing on that. So my next question for you is, what made you make the decision to lean into that strategy? How did you get from, you know, I guess, point A to point B? And then, you know, my second question is, I'll just like, you know, throw it out there. Your message in the market currently, you just said it, beauty on your terms. It feels like marketing personalization would be a big part of this, right? Because it's on your terms. You've embraced a year-round, always-on strategy of partnering with us across several of our cultural moments. And how do you see those fitting together? So, two-part question.
So I think, first of all, it starts with where you are at any point in time and what you determine is the next best steps for that brand, given the environment it's playing within. So, for example, for us, how did we lead to this leaning into beauty on your terms and so forth is that we have a really, really good product that needed increased awareness. Once that product has increased awareness, you can do a lot more with it. You know, you can send people to a lot more places for it, but you've got to start by understanding that it needs increased awareness.
Right.
So how does it get that? Well, we started out internally. If you'd heard this internally, we would say, we've got to make Xeomin famous. And so how do you make it famous? Well, how do you make anybody famous? You know, you get the right people to talk about it. You get the right brand partners to support that conversation, and you show up where famous people are or where famous things are going on, right? Cultural moments that we all follow. So we've, I mean, listen.
Like Vanity Fair Oscars. Well,
it's been the pleasure of my life to be able to do some of these things, which as a kid on my sofa at home growing up loving the movies, never thought that I could possibly attend a Vanity Fair Oscars party. So it, believe me, pleasure of my life. But to show up there, to show up at our Vanity Fair event in Las Vegas, to be part of the Vogue kickoff at New York Fashion Week, right? And my personal favorite, the Glamour Women of the Year, by the way, as an aside, like, this is the most inspiring event I have ever been to, and I got to go twice, and I would not want to miss it from here forward. It is the most amazing thing, and I think everyone should have an opportunity to attend it, except it's a small audience, but everyone should go. But anyway, people follow these events, and so by being within that event, you become culturally relevant throughout society.
Right? Yeah, and Kaylee and I were just talking about how, like, these types of moments, they are content generators, right? So when you think about, you know, people are like, oh, I want to be at the center of culture. It's like, you know, it isn't so easy for brands to just be at the center of culture because, you know, it takes quite a selection of ingredients for that to be possible. Number one, I think I give you all so much credit for knowing that you needed to build your brand and for your brand to be something that consumers knew what it was and what it was there for. And then also really like being ambitious about being at the center of culture and then picking those cultural moments as you did. And I could not agree more. Glamour Women of the Year is probably one of the most inspiring events because it is about empowering women. I think Beauty on Your Own Terms speaks really perfectly to that because it really is about women that have gone out in the world and are doing things on their own terms and really kind of aspiring but executing on that promise. I look at events like, I usually don't get this opportunity to like, you know, brag about our own events, but the partnership actually speaks so organically to that. You know, the Oscar party really is about celebrating the best in the industry, you know, once a year, recognizing the Oscar winners. But again, you have this moment where you have an audience that is there to be a part of the celebration, to joy in the red carpet, obviously to have this like access point to this amazing experience and having your brands at the center of that. Again, sends, I think, a message to the not only the industry, but the consumers that are there paying attention. Hey, this is a brand that is speaking to me. It's on my terms yet again. One point I just want to make, I think it's easy to say, but it's very hard to execute on. When I think about our partnership, about where you were going to show up and ultimately how you're going to measure that then, right? Because everyone's like, well, cool, you got to go to all these great events. What was the KPI? How are you measuring success as a marketer?
So part of it is, are you showing up in the cultural events? Check the box. We have done so, right? And we've done so in a great way thanks to the help at Condé Nast. Secondly, though, then, are we getting conversation to occur post those events? Yes, we can follow that and see that. Are we increasing awareness of the product, which was part of that initial intent? Yes, we've measured that and we've seen a 4 or 5-fold increase in awareness just over the year and a half or so of our campaign. The rest of it requires us to make an intellectual leap Now, I call it an intellectual step because I don't think it's that big a leap, okay? But time spent and invested in this type of word of mouth activity is by and large good. And so we have to sort of know that. Like corporately, you like to put some dollar spend and then the correlating sort of uptick. And you want to relate just that dollar spend to just that uptick that it correlates to. Almost impossible to do. The large pharmaceutical company that runs the ad on TV, that runs during the whatever broadcast, and you look at that ad and you're then enticed to do something, there's no way they can measure.
Right.
Other than anecdotally, maybe a provider saying, oh, more people are coming in and asking. But I guarantee you, if they see an uptick in revenue or they see an uptick in market share, they're going to correlate that to the ad campaign that they've run. Mm-hmm. So we have to make that intellectual step to understand that that's what's going on. For us, market share has grown. Revenue has increased on a product where competition has become steeper and the market's become more crowded. And the only thing we really changed was investing and leaning into the campaign, thanks to Roberto Casas, our VP of marketing, in terms of really turning us on to what we needed to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is always hard to do something first because ultimately people are watching. And I do think, listen, it's interesting, this strategy that you all have, because it is at probably the most important time as the media industry changes. Culture as a KPI is becoming probably one of the bigger, most requested asks that we see. And so I'm super excited to be working with you all on that. What I think is also interesting about how people define culture is even how people now define influencers and what is sitting really at the intersection of influencers and authenticity. I always say to people, it doesn't really matter how many followers an influencer has. It matters whether or not those people actually have influence. And you've spoken in the past about the intersection of influencer and authenticity, and that's something that the entire industry has struggled with. You've worked with just a couple of cool people, Christina Aguilera, Joe Jonas. I have to tell you, I'm a personal fan of Teyana Taylor, among others.
Amazing.
Amazing, I have to be honest. How have you navigated that, and what has been the response?
So, boy, have we been fortunate, as you said. And every one of these folks have done such a beautiful thing by what I say is they've lended their brand to our brand. And I think that's a big deal when someone decides to do that, right? And is willing to do that. So we love that. Of course, we just launched our latest, if you will, a celebrity brand ambassador, Demi Lovato.
Who was at the Oscar party,
who was at the Oscar party.
In the photo booth.
And she is just absolutely beautiful inside and outside. Like, what a beautiful human being. All about her, right? And so I think this idea that you raised of how do you navigate it and how does this intersection work with authenticity, I think I'm so happy we're in a place where authenticity plays, you know? And I think the offshoot of that is that when you're authentic, even vulnerability, once considered a weakness, can now be very endearing. I never thought it was a weakness. I always thought that was kind of silly because if we're really going to get to know each other, how can we do that if neither of us is willing to be vulnerable at any point in time, right? So I've always thought that's a key ingredient to any relationship we choose to strike out in life anyway. But I love that I think we get it now more and more. Sometimes authenticity is hard to tell. We need multiple exposures, right? Particularly in a social media generation where people can put a false narrative out there and it make it look really good. So we may need a couple of exposures to determine that. But once we do, we know authenticity when we hear it and see it. We're pretty good at that. And so I think we've been so fortunate that these brand partners of ours have been truly wonderfully authentic.
And so well-timed, right? Kaylee and I were just talking about AI. I swear, it doesn't matter who I speak with. The one thing they're worried about is authenticity. Like, how will we prove this was a real person? How will we prove that this was generated by, you know, real journalists, real writers, real brands? Again, I mean, you guys are really, like, you know, leading the curve. But I do think the approach to always come from an authentic place and partnering with influencers who are real influencers. You know, the irony of that statement is, you know, just means so much because as a company that has brands like Vogue and Vanity Fair and Glamour, these are all brands that is like our number one goal is to strive for authenticity, to produce something we really believe in that will bring in a real audiences that are really engaging. And you had talked about engagement a minute ago. And I think when you have real influencers that really connect both with your potential customer and the brands that you are responsible for. I know it's not simple, but it can be that simple. You know what I mean?
I totally agree. I love the concept of that, right? Where when they're truly leaned in, truly authentic. But, you know, it occurs to me that the authenticity required for that to occur begins with us. In this case, begins with us as a company. Do we have an identity crisis or do we know who we are? Right? And if we know who we are we keeping that to ourselves or are we putting it out there to the population? Are we proud of it and willing to stand by it? If we are able to do that and to expose the public, both healthcare providers and consumers, to ourselves in an authentic way, we can then attract similar levels of authenticity who likely share our values, who likely share our vision for what's going on. That's what led us to this great partnership with Condé Nast and with many of these influencer and brand partners. It's all about that, you know, and with because in the end of the day, it's people. Right?
Well, and it also requires, and this is, I think, irony here as well. It requires, and listen, you are part of the pharmaceutical industry where, you know, you don't take risks, right? Because ultimately you have to, like, everything has to be measured and everything has to be proven with real science, real data, real regulation. But as a marketer, I have to say, you guys have taken some real risk and you've really, like, put yourself out there in a way that, and when I say that, I mean that through how you rethink measurement. And how you rethink the future of search or the future of how you're going to find your next consumer. And ultimately, those are the things that I think define strong brands because the playbook is changing. The consumer has moved on. Ultimately, you have to move on with that consumer. And again, stay authentic at the same time. It's not easy to do.
You're very right. And, you know, there's no sense being a passive participant in what's going on. You've got to be active in terms of pushing the elements and agendas that you want to push today. Otherwise, it'll never get through. So we've sort of taken that activation. It's the whole thing behind even calling the campaign Beauty on Your Terms.
Right.
That is in itself an empowering thing. It suggests that you shouldn't be taking that advice from us, even though we'd love for you to use these products. You should define for yourself what it is that allows you to live your best and most authentic life. And if that happens to include aesthetic products like we have, then we want to be your trusted partner. We want you to think of us and we want to be there for you every step of that journey. But if, however, that's not you, then we want to honor and respect that choice. Beauty on your terms means not everybody chooses it, and that's okay. And enough of the judgment that goes on today, the misinformed judgment about everybody's everything. That's enough of that. And we don't want to participate in that. We want to be an active participant in the best outcomes for society to include freedom of choice.
The idea that we're making informed decisions that have actionable results, I think, are the areas where I think there's lots of opportunity for consumers. Okay, before we end, because I think, you know, I speak to a lot of marketers every single day. So last of the like businessy questions. I want to touch on your, if it's okay, I want to touch on your personal philosophies on leadership and growth. Because again, there's only so many opportunities that we get to speak to marketers in this way with our listeners. You know, I've heard you say that, and you've said it actually a couple times while you're sitting here, that you take care of people and people take care of the rest. What does that mean to you both professionally and personally?
I think people are at the center of everything. Everything that we tend to give credit to the brand or the building or the company or whatever, in the end, that's made up of really good, talented, hardworking people that make those things come to life. And for somebody else, that person is the brand. That person is the company. So that's always at the forefront of my mind. And when I think about then what's my obligation to that equation, right, then I think about, well, as a leader, I could look at things two ways. Either I could assume that it's my job to fix all the problems, and God knows I could find them every day. Or I could say, I would rather take care of all the people and create an environment where the best people do their best work and trust them to solve the problems. So I'm always asking myself questions like, are we being fair to them? Are we giving them all the tools they need to succeed? Are we encouraging them to fail on their path to success? Are we sitting down with them and hearing from them? Because by the way, good ideas come from all people. I don't care about titles. Good ideas come from all people. So are we sitting down and listening to them? And are we providing forums and environments where they can do their best? That's going to get us the outcomes that we're after, way more than me taking a personal responsibility for all those things and trying to solve it on my own.
I love that. I try to live to that. I don't know. I was about to say subscription, but like the reality is like it is an important way to lead, to guide. Because if you have people that feel empowered to make the right decision, then ultimately, you know, it allows you to do a lot more things. I know you also believe that it takes, and I personally believe this as well, it takes confident people to do great things. In this conversation, I've definitely seen that from you. You seem pretty confident. Is that something that you've always had, or did you grow into it? Is this something that you help guide other people to become more confident? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I guide them now, but I certainly grew into this. I mean, if you had met me 30 plus years ago, I was shy as can be. I was not out in front. I would have been voted least likely to stand in front of an audience and talk to them for more than 2 minutes without running away. Like, I mean, this was just not who I was. But my own personal journey, I mean, I remember the first time I ever did anything like that scared me in public. I was playing a guitar and singing a song in the at the communion at church, and I was doing it in a choir loft behind the people.
Wow.
And I did it because I didn't want to look at their faces. I was scared to death, right? And so I sat up in that choir loft and played the guitar, and I thought, well, this will be pretty easy. I'm playing to the back of people's heads and half of them are asleep. But as soon as I started playing, they all turned around. I got really nervous. I started sweating and my legs were shaking, although they couldn't see that. But I made it through.
Yeah.
But I made it through. And so the thing I try to share with people is most of the lack of confidence comes from a discomfort about something or a fear of something. And not all the time have we put that there ourselves. Sometimes somebody else has planted it in us. So we're still the only ones who can change it. We can have a community of people that support us through it, but we're still the ones that have to overcome the fear. We're still the ones that have to get out of our comfort zone and push through it. When we do, we realize it's not all that bad and we might actually like it, and then we lean into it further. So those are the conversations I try to have with people as they struggle on that path. And that's the small piece that aesthetics can play, which is why I love this industry, which is if someone's got something that bothers them, doesn't matter if it bothers me, if it bothers them and it's in some way holding them back, then for goodness sake, do something. You know, we can help.
Do you still play the guitar?
I do.
Really?
Yeah, I love it.
What do you play?
So I like singer-songwriter stuff. Even though I was born in the 70s, I think I've always gravitated towards, you know, the 60s that came just before.
Yeah.
And then I've always loved singer-songwriters all my life. So I like to write for therapy. So I'll write songs like to make myself feel better and process through things that have gone on. I don't really play those out anywhere, but I write them. And then I like to write song parodies about the aesthetics industry. And I play them at national sales meetings and stuff like that, just as a fun cultural moment for
I love that. I see another campaign coming maybe as well. Okay, for real this time, last question. I hear you have three kids. I have three kids. Boys, girls.
I have three boys.
I have three boys.
Wow.
This is what I call real parenting.
Look at that. Right? Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So this is a question that's near and dear to my heart. Watching them grow up, what makes you encouraged for this next generation? And how old are your kids? That would help.
Yeah, so 21, 17, 15.
Great. You have a little bit of a foresight because mine are 14, 12, and 9.
Ah, very cool.
So what do I look forward to?
Well, you know what? We all hear lots of things about this current generation. But I watch my kids. I watch them evolve. I talk to their friends. Like, I love sitting down with young people and just talking to them. And not like the wise old man that wants to teach something. Like, we got to be humble and we got to learn from all aspects of our environment. So I'm very optimistic about this generation, actually. If we think about the degree of difficulty for them, they are born into life with social media and distraction following them around in their pocket in the form of a smartphone from the first day to now. So that's a lot to deal with and figure out and navigate around. And yet, I find them to be more accepting, more likely to include others across a broad spectrum of things we're trying to solve as a society. And I love that. And it speaks to a greater future if we can lean into that stuff. They are less obsessed with money and stuff than I was. I'll put myself on the line on that one. And I think that's great, right? And I think that there's lots of good things that they can do. We just got to give them time. They're young. This Gen Z is just evolving and they're young. And so we got to give them time to figure it out. And we got to be there along the way to support them. We got to stop judging them and calling them a bunch of names because they don't look exactly like some past generation used to look. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't. That's called evolution. That's called growth.
I could not agree with you more. Well, listen, Patrick, president of North America at MERS Aesthetics, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I am personally looking forward to more years of working together and continuing this conversation.
Xeomin in Cabotulinum Toxin A is an FDA-approved treatment used to temporarily improve the look of moderate to severe frown lines between the eyebrows. Effects of Xeomin may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor, as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness can be signs of life-threatening conditions. Side effects may include allergic reactions, headache, injection site pain, eyelid drooping, and swelling. Tell your doctor about medical history, muscle and nerve conditions, and all medicines, especially botulinum toxins, muscle relaxant, and blood thinners, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects. Doses of Xeomin are not the same as all botulinum toxins.
I want to thank everyone for listening. I'm Pam Druckerman, and this is Tell Me What You Really Think from Condé Nast. And thank you for telling me what you really think, Patrick.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.